welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Ritt, and I'm once again joined here by Mr. David Holmes. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Not doing too bad. For a warm Friday afternoon.
Warm indeed. So warm that producer Miles isn't here. That's nothing to do with why he's not here, but no producer Miles this week. It's just the two of us, but we still kept order, I think. I don't think that was too rowdy a session that we've just had.
I think we'd be able to ourselves remarkably. And I'm feeling a bit of competition for the soapbox, but that can only be healthy.
Yeah, you might be right. I might have indulged slightly this week, but, you know, there were some important topics. So for your benefit, listener, what you will hear on today's session is that, as you will no doubt be aware, if you're in the UK, but even if you're abroad, you know, it's big news. Our Prime Minister here, Boris Johnson, has announced that he will be stepping down following a spate of resignations after a spate of scandals, quite frankly, let's be honest, but that's a separate issue. And while, obviously, this is a data protection and privacy podcast here, politics are still never too far away because, of course, the direction of travel for a lot of the issues in our immediate field are dictated by our politicians. And there were a number of things over the last couple of weeks since that resignation which were particularly relevant to data protection and privacy and, more broadly, information rights and rights at all, actually, weren't they, Dave? I mean, it's a broad spectrum, but there was a lot of political movement which was important to our sector.
Well, there were. I mean, we often talk in and around politics because, like I say, it's in essence linked to rights and the rights that we have. But unfortunately, the negative direction of travel with politics is potentially meaning less rights and an undermining of that fundamental right that we all have. I think we navigated it well, and I think it's and I think we did right for kind of calling out the direction of politics.
Yeah, and so that's why, listener, there's a bit of competition for Dave's soapbox this week. I may have snuck up there with him because I had a number of thoughts on those issues, but it's all important, you know. Ultimately, as those of us who are voters in this country, it's incredibly important that we're aware of these issues and we're informed, and it helps to subsequently inform our decisions about, you know, who represents us and the impact that has on our specific area, but more broadly on, you know, and those around us. So,
and on,
and I wanted to get, with, sorry, go with, on.
Without inflating it too much, and on the presence of democracy, really.
Well, that's very true, because we did also talk about elements which were relating to accountable and transparent government, which are fundamental pillars of any democracy, right?
For sure.
So we mentioned that a little bit. You'll get to that. But we did spend a fair bit of time talking about the politics around it. We also spoke, again, because it's been in the news a lot recently, but we spoke once again about the ICO's direction of travel. So they this week have published announced their plans for their direction for the coming year in terms of their priorities. Some really interesting things in there that we talked a little bit about. And once again, Dave, praise for the commissioner and his office.
And a slight plea bargain in the fact that we will give mayor time.
Yes, that's very true. If you're listening, John, come on down and say hello. We'd love to have you on. We promise we've been a lot nicer about your office since you joined. but, you know, it's on record. You can go and check. We spoke about that a little bit. And then just, you know, little bits and pieces. We had quite an interesting conversation about the practicalities of deploying WhatsApp as a communication channel. I think there's more in that that we could maybe come back to another time. But really interesting conversation. And you know, that there were bits in there. We mentioned potentially the return of the plans for DPP Live, DPP on tour. So keep your eyes and ears peeled for that, listeners, if you're interested. I'd relegated that to the back burner for the time being, but it's very much intended to make a comeback, and we were asked about it today. So, you know, why not? Let's expedite those plans to bring it back. I'm sure, Dave, that just like me, you're looking forward to the prospect of getting out there and getting to meet some of our regular listeners and contributors, peers and colleagues that we get to meet virtually every week, but perhaps not in the flesh just yet.
For sure. I think it's I know we've spoken about it quite a lot, and I'm really excited about it. I think the whole idea of trying to take it on tour and maybe doing it live from different parts of the country, or even live from some clients' offices if they're allow us to use some of their offices. So it's I just think it's a great prospect, and I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. So on that note, we will be back next week with another episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. It's a themed episode this week. As you know, we like to alternate. We'll be talking about audits. It's going to be called Be Audit You Can Be, because the producer Miles, who's not here to defend his pun, which possibly does need some defending, because I'm not sure it's as strong as your puns, Dave.
No. I was thinking about calling it To Audit or Not To Audit. That is the question.
Yeah. Yeah, it's less of a pun, but it probably works better thematically than producer Miles, but don't tell him I said that. So yeah, we'll be back next week with that. If you weren't able to catch up on last week's episode, I would strongly urge you to do so. It was aimed primarily at the housing sector, but extends far beyond that. We were joined by our colleagues over at 3C Consultants, which was absolutely brilliant. So we had Colin Sales on, CEO of 3C, talking to us about data accuracy, data quality, the issues around that, the value of having good data. Really fascinating chat, Dave, wasn't it? I mean, we had a great time talking to Colin, so we'd very much urge people to go back and listen to that if possible.
For sure, and I think it's one of the guest speakers that maybe even challenged you or me for airtime. He certainly likes to talk, which is maybe rich coming from us too.
Yes, absolutely. Which I'm aware that this intro is rapidly spiraling out of control. So, without further ado, Dave, I suggest that we let the listeners get stuck into this latest episode, and we will catch up with them very soon.
Will do. Enjoy.
Anything you want to start us off with? I've got a packet, if you like, of items which are broadly all politics related. Now, I do apologise in advance. We sometimes spend a little bit too much time talking about politics on what is fundamentally a privacy feed, but it's always important. It's always relevant. So I've got a couple of stories relating to that. I don't know if there's anywhere you want to start before that, Dave, because I know that will likely get you riled up. So
I'll take the slightly easier approach, possibly of not necessarily criticising it, but we can't avoid the fact that Bojo's on his way out. In that sense, so we're going to have a change of government, although it's going to still be a Conservative government. We're going to have a change at the top. And what does that necessarily mean for the Data Reform Bill? In that sense, we've certainly we spoke about, was it last week, week before, about some of the elements of the proposed. Well, to be fair, the government's response to the consultation process that could be used to give direction, certainly direction of travel into where things may go. It's certainly not the law, but it can certainly give indicators of where that may go. There's still a legislative process to go through. But is that now dead because of the change at the top and having a new prime minister? Will that have an impact on whether the data reform considerations will go ahead? Will there be sufficient legislative programme available for that to go through? Or will the new prime minister, after a period of time, possibly whilst riding high, if there's any kind of immediate changes in the polls, call a snap election in order to have their own mandate? What will that do to all of that, and whether it'll be changing anyway? So that's kind of the first one I was thinking of initially for today's topic. I don't know if you've got anything you wanted to kick around on that one.
Well, just a couple of things. First things first, it was 2 weeks ago that we last spoke about this. That's because last week we had a really, really good chat with our friend Colin Sales, CEO of 3C Consultants, about data accuracy and data quality. Very, very interesting chat. If you weren't party to that, I do urge you to go and check out the recording, available across all audio streaming platforms and on our website. Very good chat, wasn't it, Dave? So it was
2 weeks ago that we last spoke about this, you've skipped ahead a little bit in my plan because I did have this on the plan for the session. One of the things that's worth raising is I believe as part of all the cabinet resignations leading up to Boris Johnson's ultimate resignation was a junior minister who was heading up the data reform bill, I think, or was heading up at least the changes associated with this within the DCMS. So I think
you did well to capture that, because I think at one point was there something like 40 odd ministers or advisors, something. There's quite a number, like, wasn't there? So you did well to catch it, because it's you just interview the minute there's somebody else leaving at one point.
Yeah, I can't claim full credit for that. I think someone picked it out on my feed. It might have been Tim Turner, possibly. I forget, in all honesty, but I definitely saw that across the socials that had happened, which of course is interesting. As you say, does that mean that this will fall by the wayside? I'd certainly expect it to lose a little bit of traction. I think that's probably fair. But as you say, you know, is it going to be the case that with a change of government, well, with a change of Tory leader first and then subsequently a change of government, do we then see this just sort of slip off the agenda and slide away? Who knows? I suppose it depends really on the mandate of, or at least the agenda of whoever comes in, and whether they have these sort of quite strong, you know, post-Brexit, let's reclaim things type of ideas to a lot of the reform, and therefore this is something that they might want to pick up. But if they're possibly not quite as averse, you know, it might be shelved for the time being.
Yeah,
or it might be softened. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to pick up on that. I just thought it was worth raising because it's interesting and it fits into a broader item, I suppose, for this week.
Yeah, the only reason why I mentioned that was because with a couple of my clients, I've been feeding through monitoring reports and bits and pieces when you kind of go, well, what else external is happening? I often pick up on bits and kind of give them a little snippet of information on external information. And obviously the data reform bill has been part of that. And prior to what we're talking about at the moment, obviously they were quite interested in where's the direction of travel, what we're looking at and things. So this was, it was raised more because it's just, like you said, just highlighting these things are out there with our clients. So we're raising them with our clients that these things are out there, things are changing. But now, because of a fundamental change, we'll actually go ahead. It's more just trying to keep up with the times. In that sense, and keeping our clients abreast of that. So I thought it's just a nice one to lead in with before you start getting me riled up on other areas.
Well, there's plenty more of that to come, don't you worry. but you are right, because one of my customers actually, last week maybe, week before last, whenever it was, basically came and asked me about this in this very thing, which is, you know, the reform bill's coming in. We're doing a big task with them at the minute, looking at their OPAs and their DPIs. And they came to me and said, well, I've read in the press that, you know, DPIA is going to be scrapped and that ROPAs might be scrapped. So where does this leave us? And I basically said, without wanting to be too flippant, I know sometimes you and I can be a little bit cynical on things, but without wanting to be too flippant, I said, look, I would seriously just ignore that for the time being, because A, all of these are proposals. There's nothing fixed for the time being. B, there's a lot of skepticism, I think, within our own, you know, practitioner, DPO, whatever you want to call it, community. And finally, because ultimately it would only change, it would only take, you know, political change for this to completely slip off the agenda. And that's literally what we've had. So we might find that this entire thing gets scrapped. Speaking of which, I don't know if you saw this week, Dave, it's sort of related and it's something that we've spoken about before. So I thought it was just worth raising. We've spoken previously about the, is it called the online safety bill? The online harm bill?
Yeah,
which is effectively, which has a whole host of really good ideas and reforms with it, I think. To be honest, I've not gotten to grips with it possibly as much as I should, but it's all basically targeted at making sure that, you know, some of these large internet-based companies, you know, social media platforms, etc., really go above and beyond in terms of reducing the potential for harm to users, effectively. I think
is that harm to general users, or is it a focus on child protection and that kind of thing?
I believe it goes beyond just child protection. I think there's a lot of it obviously is focused on children, so that probably segues on nicely from the age-appropriate design code of practice that we had a while ago. But I think it's targeted more generally at users. Anyone here live, please correct me if I'm wrong. But I think it goes beyond purely child protection. I raise this because, again, in sort of an interesting aspect of where our field and politics often overlap is, I don't know if you saw this, but the bill's now been put on hold for the time being. I don't know what that means practically, but I read the headline this morning, it's been put on hold. And this comes after one of the former candidates for the Conservative leader position, Kenny Badenoch, who was in the running up until recently. I think she dropped out. But previously, she'd called for this bill to be scrapped slash delayed. Because according to her, and I quote pretty much verbatim, we should not be in the business of legislating hurt feelings. Now, I do believe that she's been called out on that and corrected, because a lot of this relates to significantly greater harm than hurt feelings. We're talking about, you know, very sensitive items. We're talking about not just bullying and harassment, but, well, basically people have pointed out that it's self-harm and potentially suicide and that sort of thing. And there are very serious consequences to all of this. So, again, just...
It would seem slightly odd. I know it's not necessarily a DP issue, but it would seem slightly odd when there's greater traction and greater awareness and greater support for mental health issues to then turn around and go, we shouldn't legislate for hurt feelings. It would seem quite contrary to the direction of recognition and all the work that the relevant charities and support that's out there has been trying to move towards in relation to making sure people are fully supported from a mental health point, to turn around so we shouldn't legislate for hurt feelings. It would seem like your fingers maybe not quite on the pulse with things. Well, and I know it's not a DP issue, but still.
But there's an argument to say that it is a DP issue, right, ultimately. And I think actually this is something which generally I think a lot of peers that I speak to are very good at recognising this fact, but maybe it's not communicated to the wider public necessarily quite as well as it should be. But ultimately, I think we can be guilty sometimes of thinking of privacy and data protection in language which is a little bit too binary and a little bit too restrictive. And we think of it really as this sort of technical area. We're talking purely about personal data. But really, you know, you have to expand that. One of your main things I know you often tell people in training, Dave, is that these are real people and real people's lives at the end of the day that you're looking at. So I do think these types of things where you're looking at items like the online safety bill are incredibly important to even if they don't directly come under our sphere of influence, they still are so tangentially related that it's important to look at these things.
I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you, because the information that people may be scraping, maybe obtaining whilst operating online, has certainly got a DP issue to it in that sense. So, yeah. You know, is what you're collecting fair, lawful, transparent, and so on in that sense. So it's certainly from the online activity, what they're doing with that information, how they're collecting it, what does it tell them, and so on and so forth, really is a DP issue. And we do need to be mindful of where the online safety bill is going, because some of us may work end up working with organisations that have measures that's going to be caught by the online safety bill, and you maybe need to be mindful of around other things. So I do get the fact that it's heavily linked to the work that we do.
And ultimately, all of this, just again to loop it back around, comes against the backdrop of all the work at the minute that's being done in investigating the ed tech sector, right? Yeah. Again, not immediately related, but when you look at what's come out of the Human Rights Watch review of the edtech sector and some of those products in particular, you know, we're talking about, without wanting to paint everyone in that sector in the same light, absolutely not, because there are plenty of organizations within the edtech sector who are very on top, very privacy conscious, etc. But there were some of them who came out of that, and it appeared that they were harvesting and selling off children's data for marketing purposes. You know, that's not something which that's, you know, not been pulled out of thin air. That's something which has been found as part of this review. And when you've got that backdrop to have people in the running to be our next leader, possibly saying, well, we need to dial back on some of these things, it is quite concerning, I'd have said. In line with that, sorry,
I was just going to say, I'd absolutely agree. You got the work they're doing online ad tech is looking at limiting and preventing serious harm, isn't it? Same with AdCop, trying to prevent harm for the kids. DP is harm-based, risk-based, that kind of thing, trying to prevent harm. So then for them to turn around and say, well, we shouldn't legislate against hurt feelings, which is a form of harm, isn't it? You know what I mean? The words that the Tory minister used there, like I said, just picking on the hurt feelings bit of itself, maybe slightly outside of our remit, although it is caught by, like I say, prevention of harm and that kind of stuff through DP. I just think it's just completely off the button, quite frankly.
Yeah, and this is my point, is that it's important because the temptation maybe for us is to separate ourselves from this sphere and to say, well, this isn't really anything to do with us. You know, we're privacy people at the end of the day. We shouldn't be dabbling in this sort of thing, but we absolutely should. In line with this, and this is what I was going to segue to just a second ago, I don't know if you saw, again, and this is my last politics item, by the way. We can move on after this. I do apologize, but I do think it's important to raise these. In line with this and something that we've talked about a number of times previously on this feed, Dave, I don't know if you saw that, again, one of the candidates who has dropped out, Suella Braverman, I think that's how you pronounce her last name. I do apologize. That's right.
Yeah.
Braverman. Yeah. Sorry, I was just correcting me. So she's now dropped out, but one of her key policies, and again, I'm pretty sure I'm quoting relatively
pointless verbatim. Was she the Attorney General or something?
She was the Attorney General, but her key policy was to take us out of the jurisdiction of the ECHR, European Court on Human Rights, and to, quote, get rid of all this woke rubbish, Dave, apparently. I mean, you can't really write it. That at a time when so much of this is being... So much of this is in the spotlight, so much of this is, you know, really for us to take a good, long, hard look at, for us to have potentially, you know, future leaders say, well, we're going to dial back on all this, it's all nonsense, get rid of it, is concerning to say the very least, I think.
I would agree with you. I think it's concerning language. You know what I mean? The European Court of Human Rights has done fantastic work, I believe, in some of the things that they've delivered and some of the things that they've achieved. And I think some of the language used by people who are saying, I want to be, I am a politician, I want to be influential in government and stuff, I think they just need to be a little bit more awake themselves as to the language that they're using, and not to be, you know what I mean? I think it's very dangerous language if you're not careful. I think they need to be dialing it back a bit. I think the tone and the rhetoric and the direction it's going in is wrong.
Mark's asking me to give you your soapbox back. I'll calm down, don't worry,
I've trained
Mark,
you too well, that's the problem.
Yeah, I've spent too much time around you, clearly. But I do think, look, this is important because ultimately, as I say, not to repeat myself too much, but it's important that we recognize these issues. It's important that we hold these people who potentially are going to be governors accountable for some of these policies or, you know, some of these planned changes. So we do need to raise it. We do need to be aware of it. And actually, just to bring it back around to our bag a little bit more, I saw quite a good post on socials, which I will give credit for in just a second as I find it. Long-time listener Rickard shared it from Judith Ratcliffe. There's a nice little post about a month ago that only popped up recently for me today, which was talking about the right to privacy and what do we mean by that. And I thought that was quite a good question because we talk a lot about, and we see it quoted a lot, you know, I have a right to privacy. So just in the context of this conversation about, you know, European human rights and the court thereof, I thought it was just interesting to bring in this notion of, well, what do we mean by a right to privacy, and the fact that it is broader than just talking about, you know, keep my data safe. There's a whole lot that comes within that, which often is possibly forgotten about. And to say that we would be dialing back on a lot of this, it wouldn't just be necessarily that, you know, Google has to comply with fewer regulations in our country. There's a whole lot of things that start to be eroded when you start to take away rights to privacy. Huge amounts, you know, from our everyday lives. And I don't think it represents, this is a really controversial statement, I don't think it presents a particularly positive move for any of us, but there you go, it is what it is.
No, I think you're right. I mean, it's privacy is only one of the rights. Well, it's an absolute right, and it's a different matter, but you've got the right to privacy, and it's one of many rights, and that's why it's fundamentally linked to the European Court, as you mentioned. And I think there appears to be a serious misunderstanding of what the European Court is. I've certainly heard some MPs, and when they're talking about we need to be rid of Europe and all that kind of thing, they're tying in things that's not necessarily linked to the European Union. You know what I mean? And it's sometimes you wonder whether the MPs understand what they've voted to leave or voted to remain in and what they wanted to vote to get rid of. And I think some of them, just because it's got the word European in it, seems to think it's all necessarily linked. You know what I mean? And it's I think it's a really dangerous track to go down. I think, like I said, I'm all for remaining part of the European Court of Human Rights. I don't think we'd benefit much. I'm not saying the things shouldn't be reformed over time. Most things need reformed over time, so I'm not suggesting things don't necessarily need to have a bit of a look at and reform. We all have to do that moving forward with compliance programs, for example. We don't. It's not just a light switch moment. You're not suddenly compliant and that's it. Everything's forgotten about. You still keep your compliance program under review, and possibly touching on what we were looking at when we look at the discussion next week on audits and things. So that's, in essence, you could possibly look at opportunities for improvement. Is that type of reform? You know what I mean? But I just think I just don't necessarily agree with the political direction and the. The way the phrase things and the how it represents kind of a reduction in everything. It's just, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just, and I know it's not meant to be a political podcast, so we maybe need to wrap this one up and move on. But I just think, like you said, I think there's some very important bits of it that needs to be recognised. And one of those for me is the fact that I don't necessarily agree with the political direction on and the track that they're taking.
No, absolutely. I completely agree, Dave. I mean, it's maybe we should just rebrand this as a politics podcast and be done with it. You know, it'd probably make things a bit easier for us. But you know, it is extremely important, and particularly when, just to fold in another news story, you then get items in the press about, I don't know if you followed about this data leak from Uber. Was it last week or earlier this week? Zara's telling me last week. Zara's quite involved this week. I reckon she should come on and
tell us all
about it. No, she's look of terror in her eyes now. But yeah, no, I don't know if you saw this, Dave. Basically, a massive leak of files from Uber. And one of the things basically that comes out of that is their proximity to certain prominent European politicians.
I'd seen that. I hadn't really read about it. I'd only caught the headlines. But I had seen that. And there'd been, I think it was there was several... European politicians, weren't they, from different countries and things?
That's right, although the one that's, I think, most explicitly called out is Emmanuel Macron. But yeah, I mean, everything tied into that in terms of what can be perhaps generously described as lobbying, although that's a very generous use of that term, is quite startling, particularly when we talk about, you know, dialing back on certain statutes in this ilk. On that note, I suggest we move away from this a little bit, Dave. Have you got anything on your list which is perhaps slightly less politically inclined?
I've put a couple of bits on the list to talk through. One, I think, because we come across it quite a bit at times, and it's the, I don't know if you were aware that the ICO have reprimanded, if that's a word, to use the DHSC, so the Department of Health and Social Care, following a year-long investigation into the use of what it termed private correspondence channels. Did you come across that one?
Do you mean WhatsApp?
Well, yes.
Pretty much, yeah. No, I think we reported. We're not reporters. I think we discussed this story, shall we say, a while back. I think when it first was revealed, they were launching an investigation. They were going to probe it, which was under our former commissioner, wasn't it, Elizabeth Denham?
It was.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about the outcome of that? I mean, I know the broad lines that we're talking about. There's basically a number of issues around accountability and transparency, right? Because if senior officials are using communication channels which are potentially outside the remit of tools like FOIA, for instance, that is potentially problematic. But is that the key thing, or is there more to it than that?
Well, it's looking at the government, isn't it? So it's then looking at FOIA and potentially open government under FOIA and scrutiny and things. But I think there's also some of the key points in there, I think, is also quite relevant to other organisations as well. So private organisations that might be using WhatsApp or private channels. And I've certainly been asked by some of my clients around the use of private emails and things. So I think the essence of what you could take out of this is not necessarily just tied to public sector. So I think you can certainly take more from that. So, for example, the investigation found that there's a lack of clear controls that had the potential to lead to information in essence being lost or insecurely handled. Now, that doesn't necessarily just have to tie to government or to public authorities. The ICO in all of this concluded, as you identified, that there's risks to transparency and accountability and so on and so forth. But the findings go a little bit further than that, in the sense that the DHSC didn't have appropriate technical or organisational measures in place. I can't say that. Technical or organisational measures in place to ensure effective security and risk management. You know what I mean? So, again, you could look at that within your own organisations and go, well, if we're using WhatsApp or if we're facilitating the use of private emails, what technical organisational measures do we have over the information? What control measures do we have over that information? How would we get the information back, for example, if there was a breakdown in relationship with the person who's been authorised in that sense to use a private email account? And if there was a subject access request, how would you necessarily get access to it for retrieving that information if it's an approved app? Or it's an approved communication method by the organisation. So I think, yes, it's tailored to the DHSC. I think people need to, I would advise people to go and read it. I think if you read between the lines, there's some real bits of, some really good bits to take from the learning from this. So, for example, the use of such channels presented risks to the confidentiality, integrity and availability of the data exchanged. You know what I mean? And I think there's wider elements, not just limited to the DHSC.
Yeah, I mean, it's sorry, I was just going to mention there, but you had a point to finish. I was going to say it's particularly relevant because on our support desk this week we had a question come in basically almost immediately relating to this. It might have been the week before actually, but you know, basically a customer saying, well, we've gotten a SAR in from a former member of staff and it relates specifically to the use of WhatsApp within the business. They want messages that were exchanged on WhatsApp, and we sort of went, well, first instance, is this a recognized communication channel? Are you a controller of it? Because if not, that's a pretty easy way to deal with it. And they sort of said, ah, well, actually, they are all work phones, and we do have a policy that says people can use WhatsApp, and they can also use WhatsApp for limited personal uses, which obviously sort of Zara and I tearing our hair out over this revelation, because how on earth are you meant to manage this? And they were saying, you know, how do we go about retrieving information from individual devices in this context? Because we might end up seeing things that are highly personal if we do it ourselves. Do we instead rely on the individuals to return the search, but then they might conceal elements? You know, what do we do about that? Which obviously we inform them that, you know, there's technically an offence to do that sort of thing. But, you know, it's extremely difficult. So from the perspective of a controller reviewing this news item, you'd have to look at it and go, crikey, let's review what we're doing, because this could be really difficult for us if it got to this position. It's something which...
I'm not suggesting the use of WhatsApp is illegal. You could certainly kind of have a control measure around WhatsApp, saying, because sometimes you hear about it within serious incident management response elements. So if something really serious happened on a night and you needed to get the response team together, we'll communicate through WhatsApp. But just saying something's hit the fan, you maybe need to call us, is different to putting personal details in there, different to sharing files and information via those kind of channels and things. You know what I mean? You can limit and put some control measures around, look, it's approved for this element only. You know what I mean? In that kind of sense.
Yeah, Petra's asking me to actually answer the question instead of just dancing around it. I mean, you know, ideally, if you are going to use WhatsApp, again, I'm going to give a typical, it depends, but if you are going to use it, they do now have a proper for business solution, don't they?
Corporate solution.
Yeah, that's right, which previously was just sort of quite limited, but now I do think they have that. So arguably that would be the way to do it. If you were stuck trying to fulfill a SAR that pertains to a in this instance, personal WhatsApp function. I don't know what you would call it, a personal license, I guess, like the default one basically is what I'm trying to get at. You know what I mean?
Consumer grade.
Consumer grade, that's what I was looking for. Thank you, Dave. You know, what would you do? I think in the end, what we settled on, I'm sure Zara will tell me if I'm wrong or not, but I think what we settled on was to say that basically you're going to have to look at what you defined as personal use and what the scope of that was. So if you've told people, you know, that it's quite limited personal use and you've defined that a little bit, then maybe you've got an argument to say, well, we're going to review the information ourselves. Please bring in your devices. We'll check it. We'll retrieve the messages and whatever, because, you know, at that point you probably, on the balance of probabilities, are looking at something which is less intrusive. But if you've got nothing like that in place, then you've got a problem on your hands and you might have to rely on people to do it themselves, which could be highly problematic. Listen, sure. That's basically the best I can say, but
I think there's some of the guidance. If you had a corporate WhatsApp account, and you said that people could use it for limited personal communications, that's not a million miles away from having a corporate email account that you say you can use it for limited personal communications. Mm. You'd still have to advise people you're going to have access to it. You can see everything that's running through it in that kind of sense. If you had anything personal in there that you didn't want the organisation to look at, potentially have a personal folder for personal communications. And where possible, we won't look to that folder, that kind of setup. You know what I mean? If you're looking for stuff, if you're looking for a WhatsApp channel and you've got a group, then you say, well, we're only looking at that group. We're not looking at communications you might have had with your partner, saying I'm going to be home late from work, for example. We're just going to look at the group that's in the scope of the DSAR request. We're not going to look at anything else, because you're still entitled, remember you mentioned privacy earlier, you're still entitled to privacy in the workplace.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing, and that covers your communications as well. So if you're going to dip in and out of communications, you're going to have a justifiable reason for doing so. In that sense, you're going to have to do it in a way that you're not going to use it as a phishing exercise, and you're going to have to make sure people are aware from the very outset that communication channels are monitored and may be called upon or looked at for the purposes of ensuring compliance with the law or compliance with and data protection law or compliance with internal policies and procedures to make sure you're not inappropriately using devices.
Mm. I mean, it's incredibly difficult because arguably you get yourself in a situation. This is kind of one of the things, just to link it back to the original news story, that Petra's asking whether you could ask staff to delete these messages every month. You could. I mean, again, this is one of the things we always say. If you're struggling with SARS, one of the number one ways to help that is to have good retention criteria in place, right? Nip the issue in the bud. You don't have to search for stuff that doesn't exist. So, you know, that's not saying you should have...
Again, you'd probably want that backing by a formal retention. If you've got formal communication channels, then you really ought to have that identified on Europa with a formal retention schedule behind it.
Yeah, 100%. I'm not saying you necessarily have the most aggressive policy on that, but, you know, there's one way to look at it. But again, to bring it back to the original news story, this is where it gets tricky, because what if you've got communications there which are theoretically personal but also might relate to business practices? If you're saying, well, I'm going to be home late tonight, etc., but that's because, and then you start to moan about your boss or whatever, you criticise bits and pieces, you make unfounded allegations against them, or about them rather, you know, where do you stand on that? All of a sudden the lines start to blur. Alan does make a good point, which is that obviously if you, in certain cases, you'd be subject to the Public Records Act, which would probably hamper your ability to have a particularly aggressive retention schedule. So for the public sector, that's a slightly different issue. But, you know, this is part of the thing that we're always saying, because it's such a broad tapestry. One of the things that Zoe points out is that other apps like Signal and Telegram have apparently much better security than WhatsApp. So, I mean, look, I don't want to be down on them, because, well, I don't know what they would do to me, but you know, it's something which I generally advise customers against, because it's very difficult to manage.
Yeah,
not impossible, just very difficult.
I would possibly suggest, although you could argue it's maybe not caught in as strict as the sensors are needing a DPIO, because is it actually high-risk processing in that sense? I would certainly suggest running it past the DPIO to kind of look at How it's set up in that kind of sense. Look at what you're going to be using for. Put some control measures around that. If you're looking at if information went through WhatsApp or private emails or any other communication channels, how would you access them under a subject access request, for example? And to actually go through those kind of mental agility exercises. You know what I mean? It's that kind of, might not be high risk, but it might help iron out what you need to be addressing from control measures in that sense in order to determine whether you want to use it as an official communication channel or not.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'd completely agree with that. I mean,
just on that point, sorry, and it's only because it's on my mind because I've seen it a couple of times in DPIAs recently. When they do a DPIA, it talks about how will you give effect to information rights about whatever we're assessing here. I sometimes see, and it's a bit of you had your soapbox moment, and I won't take up for this one, but I sometimes see with that bit about information rights where we've got a policy and procedure on it. You know what I mean? And you go, well, that's fine. Most organisations should have a policy and procedure on it. But if you're talking about WhatsApp in this example, as opposed to just saying rights will be handled by the policy and procedure, what you should be putting in that bit about rights is, well, how do we get access to the information? If we had a subject access request, how do we get access to the information? Do we need to go to WhatsApp or the service provider? Can we self-serve ourselves? You know what I mean? And go through that bit. It's not just that we got a policy and procedure as a get-out clause. It's what are you going to do about erasure? What are you going to do about SARS? How are you going to get access to the information and that kind of thing. So don't just fall back on policies and procedures, because it's rather a weak argument. If you ask me to assess a DPIA, I always find those as a bit of a weak argument for addressing those points.
I completely agree. Steph's pointing out that example that I gave of criticizing your boss in a text might have come to mind a little bit too easily. That's only because I had to deal with this exact problem for a customer, Steph, I promise. I wouldn't dare have criticized my boss because that's Mrs. Midgley, who some of you will know. And she don't take prisoners, so I wouldn't even dream of it, not in a private text, nowhere. I'm just a company man like that, what can I say? Anyway, on this note about the use of this type of channel, I think it's interesting to link it in, and you might have done this in the notes, so I apologize if I'm jumping ahead, Dave, but interesting to tie into announcements around the ICO's strategy going forward, which came out at ICO 25, whenever it was, yesterday or a couple of days ago. And basically one of their renewed focus on FOIA as a regime, and the fact that our current Commissioner John Edwards believes that it's not working, basically, that it doesn't work as intended. And so really sort of emphasizing on that sort of side of their enforcement and their actions. I don't know if you...
I'd look through that. I was glazing up. Well, say glazing. I was trying to kind of
just
speed
for a change,
reading.
Then.
I was trying to speed read my way through it because there's a couple of focuses. One which said that the focus will be on debt protection issues that are disproportionately affecting disaffecting already vulnerable and disadvantaged groups, that kind of thing. But the bit that got me, and it's probably more because there's a value figure next to it, is that they're going to focus on certainty and flexibility for businesses with the intention to save businesses at least 100 million over the next 3 years. 100 million. You know what I mean? Sounds like something. They're going to have it on the side of the bus. And I'm going to be driving around. Look what John's doing. You know, it's very simply, it comes across a little bit Boris-y. You know what I mean? In that sense.
In all fairness, Dave, I think that number, although I might be wrong, because some of the numbers I saw in it were in relation to savings to businesses, brackets general overall, not to any specific ones. It was interesting because one of the examples they gave, I don't know if you read this, but they were basically saying, you know, if you're a small business or an SME who has to have a DPO and you're quoted sort of 300 quid to send that DPO on training to make sure their knowledge is right, then there's a cost associated with that. So one of the things they want to do is to provide, you know, training directly free of charge to individuals SMEs, or the materials anyway, to, you know, save that business, you know, a few hundred quid. And if you can scale that up across the country, then in theory you can get to numbers like £100 million. Listen, I'm not saying that the maths necessarily work, and I do think you're right, it probably is slightly
I get the intention to save businesses money, that's fine. You know what I mean? I've not got a problem with that. But when you're claiming it'll save them at least 100 million, it always makes me think, well, how the hell have you calculated that? Yeah. You know what I mean? It sometimes just feels like it just, oh, that sounds a good figure to use, as opposed to, well, actually, we've calculated and these are the figures. But I do get the intention behind it. So it's I'm maybe over focusing on 100 million and not the intention, because they do come out saying that they'll publish data protection and FOIA training materials that they'll create, which I think is a good one, actually. I think this next one, they'll create a database 100%. Of the ICO's advice provided to organisations and the public in that sense. Yeah. The only advice back to the ICO on that would be, can you please make sure you've not got conflicting advice in your database?
And please, can everything be version controlled? We've so learned about that before.
I think they've come out with some really, really good bits in there. You know what I mean? Like, I agree with the SME training necessarily on that you mentioned, if it's going to cost them, especially for really small organizations, that kind of thing. They're on about creating an ICO moderated platform for organizations to discuss and debate compliance and share information and advice between each other. Can that necessarily be a bad thing? I don't think so. You know what I mean? If it's moderated, so they can actually go, oh, actually, the advice maybe isn't quite right in this area, that kind of thing. So I think that, again, glossing over the initial snap at 100 million, I think there's probably some good kind of intentions in there. I think it'd be interesting to see how they translate into practice, but I think there's some good parts in there. I was also quite interested to see towards the end that they've put some kind of KPIs in place for themselves. Have you seen these? Did you come across these bits? So the ICO intends to assess and respond to 80% of data protection complaints within 90 days and respond to 90% of data protection complaints within 6 months and ensure that less than 1% of the complaints caseload are over 12 months old.
Yeah, good stuff.
I think that good sounds stuff. All pretty good. Makes you wonder what it currently is at. When you read these KPIs, you go, you want less than 1% of over 12 months old. How many are actually outside of 12 months at present? You know, I mean, maybe that's a FOIA request.
One of mine is over 12 months old, let's put it like that.
So I think the intention is to throw that in.
No, I mean, absolutely. The intention is definitely there. I think, you know, it's all the right things. You know, more of this, please. Let's just actually crack on with it. You know, get some of these things in place. One of the things I did like, and you touched on it very briefly there, I think, was you know, focusing on those who are potentially vulnerable or disadvantaged. I noticed one of the things that they very specifically called out, which, you know, I thought was interesting that they focused on this so aggressively, seemingly in their messaging anyway, was that they're going to be looking into the effect of AI and algorithms on bias, particularly on those from different ethnic backgrounds, and they even mentioned people who are like neurodivergent and that sort of thing, which is interesting, and the impact that it can have on those people in the recruitment context. I thought those were really— it's a very good thing, don't get me wrong, but I just thought it was interesting to see that highlighted quite so prominently as an area for them to focus on. And I'm not entirely sure where that's come from necessarily. Sorry, if I can just read the specific. Considering the impact the use AI in recruitment could be having on neurodiverse people or ethnic minorities who weren't part of the testing for this software. I mean, again, yeah, no, 100%. And we've mentioned it before. You know, I've mentioned one of those Netflix documentaries that's quite good on, it's harrowing, but it's interesting in terms of how AI can be trained using data sets which aren't particularly diverse. So it's a really, really good thing. I just thought it was an interesting— not hill to die on, that's not what I mean, but an interesting, you know, pledge from them in terms of their strategy. So lots of good things.
I still think there feels like there's been a bit of a positive change from the ICO with John Edwards coming in, and that's by no means having any kind of negative connotations towards Elizabeth Denham, but just recently we've been quite positive when we've spoken on these sessions in relation to what's coming out of the ICO. This would seem to support the fact that, again, we're talking quite positively. It'd be interesting to see what the result of it would be. Like I said, it'd be interesting to see what the outcome of it may be and that kind of thing. and what it may translate to in practice. But the intention seems to be one that I generally think is a positive thing.
No, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And on that note, because some of you may have seen, if you follow us on the socials, that producer Miles took it upon himself to publicly invite our commissioner along to this podcast, which is an interesting strategy from producer Miles. We'll see if it pays off. But we have been trying to get John to come down and speak to us on this platform. We appreciate it's not necessarily, you know, the biggest platform or the least or the most glamorous. And at times we have been down on, well, maybe not his office, the office generally, probably predating him more than anything. But, you know, I do think everything that we're hearing from his office since he's taken over is very positive, and we would very much like to speak to him. But
and I think our listeners would maybe agree that in order to sway it for John to come on the podcast, we may have to give him some airtime, because, you know, the both of us can talk a bit.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It'd be a very brief appearance if he did come on, just about get a word in edgeways. Steph's just saying, better updates needed, e.g. the IC around consultation that closed in March 2020. Oh, sorry. So I see what you mean. Steph's basically saying that one of the things that is needed is more drive around, just more drive generally, I think. So one of the examples he points out is the Direct Marketing Code of Practice, which has been in draft since March 2020.
But I'm led to believe that's the government hold-up, though, because you've got to lay it before Parliament for something like 40 days.
Is that what it is?
For to criticise. And I think there's been a couple of bits from the government, possibly. I mean, I might be wrong. I'm more than happy for somebody to correct me. But I believe it was produced and it went to the next stage of going in front of Parliament. And for whatever reason, it's got held up at that point.
Yeah. I got very confused by Seth's message. For those that are not live with us, he's popped a joke in relation to that, about the fact that it's the consultation period closed over 26 months ago, and that the gestation period of an elephant is 18 to 22 months. Therefore, it's the elephant that's not in the room. And listen, love your work, Steph, but that really threw me when I tried to read it. I was like, what on earth are you talking about? But yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree. You know, it is something which I didn't know that, Dave, to be honest with you. I didn't know that might be where the holdup is, but you do feel that generally speaking, even if we ignore this specific example, there are a number of guidance elements that are out there at the minute that don't seem to have been touched in donkey's years, you know, just sort of left to abandon.
For sure. And I think I'm not just necessarily coming out all for the ICO at the moment, but they're not necessarily going to get things right all of the time, and they're not necessarily going to get things that we all necessarily agree with. But the overall view from me at the moment is the fact that it just seems to be more positive, and we're speaking more positively of things that are coming out of the ICO.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to mention on their regulatory approach announcements. Obviously there's loads in there, and I believe that one of our colleagues is writing a blog on that potentially next week, so if that's of interest, obviously keep your eyes peeled for that.
Let's not forget that the conference is on Tuesday.
Yes,
the
very true.
Conference is on Tuesday. So it's just keep your eyes and ears open for what's going on, and if you hear of anything that you'd like us to have a chat about, or to have a podcast on, or bits and pieces, and do let us know. We'll be keeping a keen ear on it as well, where we can. But if you come across anything, then please do share them. But I just think it's quite interesting, the ITO25's approach, which I think is quite positive. So yeah.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Just to come back a little bit on something we mentioned there, which was the use of AI, particularly how it's trained, possibly. Slightly dodgy link, but I'm sure you'll allow me. I saw that this morning, that very recently, particularly interesting in the wake of all the Clearview AI enforcement action across Europe, that a couple of major retailers in Australia have come under fire from their Australian watchdog for using facial recognition in store, and basically literally just having cameras up that they claim are for crime prevention, detection, security purposes, etc. but the basically a you know, taking
staff.
No, customers, sponsors, and using facial recognition technology, and you know, collecting. I don't know what the exact word they use is. It's basically the collecting a scan of people's faces. There's a very specific term for it, and I do apologize. I've forgotten what it is, but and collecting these on a whole host of customers, and no one seems to be aware that this is happening either, which is pretty poor.
Are these different retailers to the 7-Eleven, I think, which we spoke about? Because they were doing facial recognition in store.
Yeah, they are different. It's, I forget the other one, but one of them is Bunnings.
Okay.
I forget the other one. But yeah, they're different to the 7-Eleven because it was mentioned in the article I read. So yeah, I mean, you know, just to sort of, again, loop it around quite nicely to what we've been discussing previously. If you're looking at rights in this sector being eroded, possibly, and you've also got private sector organizations, commercial businesses using increasingly intrusive and invasive technology.
What was the purpose of monitoring?
Doesn't sound great.
Facial recognition of customers, then, was that tied to if you're on a known watch list, we'll know when you've entered the building? That kind of thing.
No, it's just. Sorry, I was going to say, as far as I'm aware, it's literally just the normal use of CCTV, which is if someone nicks something, you know, we can go and find them. But they're collecting actual, the term I was looking for is face prints, apparently, which is, I suppose, a fingerprint, but of someone's face.
But
they're collecting this purely, seemingly, for the purposes of prosecuting shoplifters, which is extraordinary because it's in no way proportionate. It's poor.
More chance of finding them if we know exactly who they are through facial recognition.
Well, yeah, but yeah.
Crikey.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary and certainly not a positive development. We are quite down on this channel, aren't we? Probably need to find some more upbeat stories. Although we were just very complimentary of the ICO's approach. But yeah, anyway, I saw that. I just thought it was worth raising because it's quite interesting and fits into broader conversations we've been having. Anything else from you, Dave? Because if not, I've got one sort of final point I wanted to bring up.
Just one, and it's only probably going to show me age more than anything else, but it would sound like with the Australians and the use of facial recognitions in the shops, whether they're slightly moving towards a realistic approach to the, and I'm just trying to tie it very oddly and loosely to the Minority Report. You remember that with the pre-crime film with Steven Spielberg's film back in 2002 now, wasn't it? But that was an eye-opener with facial recognition and picking people up at the point just before committing crime. I wonder whether the Australians are pushing that as a, maybe somebody watched the movie and thought it was coming, so they decided to kind of pass that themselves.
But a couple of things. A, you do mention the Minority Report quite a lot on this podcast.
That's
like the fifth or sixth time you've mentioned it down the years, I suppose, we've been doing this now. But the other thing being that, like, that's not sci-fi anymore.
But it was surveillance at that point. It was 2002, and it was about something like around about 2054 or something, wasn't it? It's a heavily surveilled society.
Yeah, and it's not sci-fi anymore. Like, the American judicial and prison systems use AI to make determinations about people's risks of reoffending and adjust their sentences accordingly. We've covered it on this podcast before. Like, it's not, like, yeah, sure, they're not scanning people's faces and determining whether they're about to commit a crime and go and pick them up, but it's not far removed, is it? I mean,
You're
pretty close at that point. All that's missing, as Mark says, is Tom Cruise.
So I guess on that, before I let you go on to your final point, because you've mentioned that I've highlighted it six times now across the series, I'll put that one to bed.
You keep bringing it up as much as you want. I just it's every time you ask me if I remember the film, and it's like, well, no, but I do now.
Have you watched it? I keep asking you. Remember?
I've not seen it. I've not seen it. No, I'm afraid not. But I tell you what, I've got now on this weekend, so I might indulge you in that respect. Steph is asking about for an update on the DPP face-to-face meetup, hashtag GlastoDPP. Well, DPP live and on tour. I don't know what we're going to call it. We're going to have to come up with something. GlastoDPP, we might get sued. But DPP on tour, certainly. Listen, it's in the works. You know, it's not gone anywhere.
We've got to be careful that we're not copying anything that Top Gear's done. We'll have silly stunts around data protection.
No. Well, I'll leave all that to you, or maybe some of the sales boys. No, that's not gone anywhere, Steph. That is still very much in the pipeline. It's just been put on the back burner slightly because we've, you know, there's been a lot going on internally at the minute. But we do still very much intend to do that. The idea at the minute is that we'd be looking at. Sorry, I don't know if my mic's playing up a little bit. We'd be looking at initially. An event up in our headquarters of Leeds for all those who are local, or not for that matter, if anyone wants to come along. And if it's a success, then we'd be looking to roll that out maybe across a couple of the locations just so it's accessible to everyone. So, you know, I'm not promising anything, but it is certainly still in the pipeline. The last thing I was going to mention as a news item, just because we've got a couple of minutes and I appreciate we start late, so we normally run over a little bit, but it does relate to the podcast. I got some correspondence from a listener a couple of weeks ago who will recognise themselves, I'm sure, which was, first of all, fantastic. It's always great to hear from peers in the field, from people who enjoy the sessions, who have bits and pieces to contribute. And in this instance, actually, this was someone challenging something I'd said, which is a first, but a very much welcome first. Someone actually, you know, picking me up on something. I'd said on a previous episode that... effectively using a US supplier, even if they keep your data in the EU, is akin to an international transfer. And this person got in touch with me and said, you know, I don't think you've got that quite right. You know, I think the interpretation of the law could be read in that way, but I don't think it should. And anyway, I put together a response for them. I'm still waiting to hear back. But the idea being that we might look at doing a full episode on this subject, because effectively we're talking about, to boil the issue down, is it possible to actually ring fence your data in a European environment owned by a US provider to such an extent that you would guard it from remote access by US agencies through things like FISA? Is that theoretically possible? That was the question. Sort of, you know, extrapolating a little bit. So if that's of interest to anyone, you know, that's something that, again, potentially a future session we're looking at. We thought it'd be really good, but also just taking an opportunity to thank that specific person for writing, but also everyone who joins us week in, week out. We do very much appreciate your support. And, you know, if there's anything that you do want to get in touch with us about afterwards that you want to pick up or you'd like to see, then obviously just let us know. Getting some thumbs up on that subject. Okay, well, we'll get that booked in. Don't you worry. Just picking up on Alan's point in the chat. I thought this was interesting. The ICO and NCSC wrote to the Law Society asking their members to stop advising controllers to pay up in ransomware cases. Apparently, they've been suggesting paying ransoms might get the ICO to go easy with any enforcement. That is very interesting, Alan. Thanks for sharing that.
I had come across this. Did you come across it, Ollie?
No, this is the first I'm reading about it. Do tell. Okay.
I have come across it. I was just trying to pick up back on the article where I'd seen it. But it's there's debate over whether they actually worded it that way. It has been interpreted to mean that they've kind of said possibly you shouldn't be paying up. I don't think I can. I had too many tabs open on my. Yeah, I've got too many tabs open. I'll have to try and dig it out. Yeah, but I have read that, and there's some feeling that that's kind of what they're indicating at, because there was something in there that they're kind of saying that you shouldn't advise paying up ransomware cases, that kind of thing. And there was a comment in there that some thought that if you pay up that the ICO might take it easy on you and that kind of thing, or that, you know what I mean. So it's interesting to see that there was a joint letter by the ICO and the NCSC in relation to that.
Yeah, they seem to be saying.
I think it's I think we'd just be careful with the interpretation. I'm not quite sure if they're saying don't pay, or whether they're just kind of looking at or whether they're kind of saying if you pay, you might not get your data back, as we've looked at before, where you might not get the key or you might only get partial information back, and it doesn't necessarily mean there's no harm and that kind of thing. So I'm not quite sure if they're actually saying don't pay up, or whether they're just highlighting the issues of paying up.
Yeah, I think what they're saying by the looks of it is that you shouldn't be quite so eager to do so, perhaps. You know, maybe don't sort of first instance go straight to paying the ransom, because there's some quotes in here from John Edwards saying that, you know, it only really incentivizes criminals. It doesn't guarantee that your compromised files are released. It doesn't reduce the scale of type of enforcement action from the ICO or the risk to individuals affected by an attack, which are all very reasonable points. But again, good initiative. It's good to see, you know, because we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, I think. I appreciate we're running out of time, but I think we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago in that not all of the action from the ICO necessarily has to be fines or enforcement against, you know, specific organizations. It's enough sometimes just to do things like this to, you know, provide your opinion on a subject and say, look, we're aware that this is a thing. We don't want you to keep doing this, because it at least gives us all a steer, which is ultimately what part of the regulator's role has to be, right?
For sure.
Sorry,
yeah.
Sorry, that wasn't much of a question there, but...
For sure. I mean, it's well, I think we covered it when you were off, and we had the two guys on talking about cyber and bits and pieces, which was another really interesting session, looking at cyber elements and ransomware and things. But it's the worrying developments in ransomware. So if you haven't listened to it, do go back and pick it up, because there's some really worrying developments. And I've not seen it, but I've certainly come across clients who have witnessed it themselves, where when ransomware is on your system, it doesn't just automatically go, oh, I've got in, lock it down, I'll have some cash. But they're kind of on there for a while, and they're nosing around for a while. And I've certainly heard of stories through clients and people they're associated with, where they've had ransomware attacks, and the malicious actors behind it all had worked out where the backups were and had actually deleted the backups before they then locked the system and said, right, now we'll have now you've got ransomware, now you owe us some money, oh, and by the way, don't look at your backups, we've just deleted them. That kind of thing. And that's a real kind of worrying development with where things are going in the development of the cyber criminal side of things.
No, absolutely. So I do encourage you all to go and take a listen back at that episode if you're interested. That was with our partners at Pentest People and Dark Invader, some of our sister businesses. Right, on that note, Dave, I don't know if there's anything else, but I think we can probably draw this one to a close.
I think so. There's probably bits we've missed. We'll scour the headlines again and see what we can find for next time. And if we have missed anything, then please do let us know, and we'll have a chat about it next time we have one of these series.
Absolutely, which will be 2 weeks from now, because as I said at the top, we'll be back next week with an episode about auditing. It's called Be Audit You Can Be. Thank you, producer Miles, for that title, and thank you everyone for your time and insights this afternoon. Thanks for joining us. We very much enjoy these. Always a pleasure to catch up with you all on this session. Dave, likewise, thanks for your time this afternoon. Good chat there. I very much enjoy that. Some interesting bits. We'll catch up on the podcast intro in just a minute, but in the meantime, hope you all have a lovely weekend. Stay safe in the heat that is to come. We're hearing some quite extreme things about Monday, Tuesday in particular, so I hope you're all keeping cool and out of the sun, and we hope to see you all very soon.
For sure. Thanks everybody, take care, and we'll speak to you soon.